At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
This is the Siecla, Supplemental 14, Emigres. Welcome back, everyone. I'd like to start off by apologizing for the fact that this is another supplemental episode, instead of the next planned regular episode. I've heard from some of you about how frustrated you are that I've been releasing a lot of interviews and other bonus content lately, instead of more researched episodes. And trust me, I get it. I want to move the narrative along as much as you do. Here's what's up. What you're about to hear is a recording I've been keeping in my back pocket for a long time. It's a talk I gave at the Intelligent Speech Conference last summer, an online event with the theme of escape. So my talk, called You Can't Go Home Again, was about the French emigres, the people who fled abroad during the Revolution, and in particular, what their experience was when they came back to France. I've intended for a while that this would be my episode for April 2022, for a reason I'll tell you about shortly. But my planned March episode, The Doctrinaires, got derailed by some real-life events. I just got a new day job, and I've also got a litter of 6 newborn foster kittens in my attic. So while this next new episode is written, I wasn't going to be able to record and edit it before April 1st. Rather than push my March episode into April by a few days, I figured I'd just flip-flop my schedule and release the finished April episode now. It's not ideal, but in the long run, you'll get the same content you were going to get, just in a slightly different order. So why was I planning this live episode for April? Well, I need to prepare my presentation for an upcoming event that some of you might be interested in. From April 22nd to 24th, I'll be a guest of honor at an online conference called Barricades, which is devoted to Victor Hugo's novel Les Misérables and its impact. I'll be participating in at least 2 events. At 1:30 p.m. Central Time on April 22nd, I'll be taking part in a panel discussion with Nemo Martin of the Bread and Barricades podcast and Professor Brianna Lewis of the Les Miserables Reading Companion podcast about our experiences podcasting about this period of French history. At 2 p.m. on April 23rd, I'll be giving a talk called Why the Restoration Matters, about how this understudied period of French history shaped Les Mis and the world. Besides my sessions, there are more than 24 other panels and talks scheduled. These include research presentations by academics about French history and literature, and also fan-driven discussions of things like Les Mis cosplay and fanfiction. So if any of that sounds up your alley, check it out. The conference is entirely online and runs from April 22nd to April 24th. Tickets for Barricades cost 10 British pounds, or about 13 US dollars at current exchange rates. Any profits left over after covering the conference costs will be donated to the nonprofit Just Detention International, which works to end sexual abuse of prisoners. You can register and find out more information at barricadescon.com. In the meantime, here's the audio of my talk from last year about French emigres. This was originally delivered live, from notes, rather than in a studio from a script, so there were rather more ums than you're used to from the Siecla. You may also notice I was working with a worse microphone than I am now. This was originally delivered with a slide deck, so as always, visit thesiecla.com/supplemental14 to view a full transcript of this talk along with period images. That transcript was produced by Jen Fuller. In the audio that follows, you'll hear me interact with a host. That's Cyrus Rodell of the Revolution One podcast.
My name is David Montgomery. I'm the host of the Siecla History Podcast. Today you've heard a lot about escape, that being the theme, and a lot of talks about fascinating and daring escapes. But for the next 20 to 40 minutes, though, I want to talk about something else, which is what happens after you escape. Specifically, I want to talk about the French Revolution and the thousands of so-called émigrés who fled the country. This is not the dramatic adventure story, the Scarlet Pimpernel smuggling aristocrats away from the guillotine. This is the less dramatic, but I would argue more interesting story of how people go on living, coping and adjusting to change circumstances. In some ways, that's the spirit of my podcast, The Siècle. I cover the history of France that people usually skip right over, the 100 years in between Napoleon and World War I. But I'd argue that this ostensibly boring period is actually incredibly interesting. It's the period in which the modern world was born. Similarly, while the dramatic escape from the guillotine may be more Hollywood-ready, I think the story of how formerly privileged people deal with their reduced situation might be more relevant for general history, for people who aren't in life or death situations. So I'm going to start off with a little bit of a quick overview of the emigration. You might be aware that France had this little thing called a revolution. The monarchy was overthrown. Lots of people were guillotined. This is incredibly oversimplifying. But as part of that, the revolution and the reign of terror, you had a lot of people who felt that for their political or social reasons that they were not going to be able to survive. They stuck around, they were going to go to the guillotine. There are other people who maybe weren't necessarily in imminent danger of losing their life, but who were unwilling to accept the revolution, the changes they thought were unacceptable. And both these groups, you have people who leave the country for the safety of other places, whether it's physical safety or moral safety. So who were the emigres? There is an incredibly complicated and vibrant and still ongoing scholarly literature to this day debating, trying to figure out how many people there actually were who took part in the emigration. And this is really hard in part because some people left for a couple months or a year and came back, while other people were gone for a generation. Perhaps the best estimate is that there were maybe 130,000 people or so who fled France. These were people of varied social status. They went to very different places. So the stereotypical emigre is the noble, the bewigged aristocrat fleeing the guillotine. And this is partially true. There were some 20,000 French nobles who emigrated during the revolution. And this includes the most famous ones, the most socially prominent, wealthy, famous emigres, the ones who were kings and dukes and bishops. Oh, not the bishops. We'll get to them in a second. And again, there's a lot of debate about how many emigres there were and how many nobles there were. But some people estimate that there were perhaps 15% of all French nobles left the country, and that a significant portion of French noble families had at least one member leave the country. A lot of times, the male head of household would emigrate, and the women would stay behind because they're seen as being less in danger, or somebody to stay behind to take care of the property, et cetera. But with 130,000 people fleeing France and 20,000 of them being nobles, that means that only a fraction of the emigres were nobles. So who were the rest? Well, a lot of them were clergy. The revolution, again, massively oversimplifying, tried to control and then later destroy the Catholic Church. About 3,000 clergy were killed, often in gruesome ways during the revolution. Some 20,000 left the priesthood. And about as many as 40,000 clergy emigrated, which would be about 25% of all the clergy in France. Now, many of these were lower-level clergy, so they were less socially prominent than the aristocrats. They get less attention. But they were far more numerically, far more of them numerically, both in absolute terms and relative terms. And if you've done the math, then you know by now that the majority of emigres were neither nobles nor clergy, but commoners, members of the so-called third estate. These were by far the least socially prominent group for a couple of reasons. One is that many of them were just servants who just were coming along with nobles. Others were peasants or sailors who may have hopped across the border when things got hot and then came back a few months later. And perhaps most importantly, while 15% of nobles left and 25% of clergy left, less than 1% of the third estate ultimately emigrated. So as a social force, it was just a much less significant group. And while mentioning this, the nobles are often overrepresented as the face of the immigration. I say that as a warning because I'm about to overestimate nobles as the face of the immigration and the rest of this, because there's simply more historical material about them. So I also want to emphasize that there were lots of differences within the emigres and not just of social status. There's a stereotype that emigres were all reactionary ultra-royalists. And at the time and since, a lot of people have used emigre as sort of a shorthand for reactionary. treating the two groups as one and the same. And of course, not all ultra-royalists emigrated, and not all emigres were ultra-royalists. Emigres were probably disproportionately reactionary. The kind of person who was most likely to leave France was the kind of person who had those far-right politics. And some people went to the right while in emigration. So one example you can see here on the right is a fellow named Mathieu de Montmorency, who was a young aristocratic revolutionary on the left side of the National Assembly. But he was driven into exile as the revolution radicalized. And when he came back to France in 1814, he was a hyper-religious, ultra-Catholic, reactionary ultra-royalist. His experience was not alone. A lot of people, the experience of being surrounded by fellow emigres, of watching from abroad what was happening to France, only hardened their position that the whole revolution was a disaster. But many emigres were moderate or even liberal. People like Talleyrand was an emigre for a while. The Marquis de Lafayette was technically an emigre. He fled the revolution because it was getting too radical and he was in danger. The Duc d'Orléans, who was the son, whose father changed his name to Citizen Egalité, Citizen Equality, as a sign of his commitment to the revolution. He was also an émigré who spent a lot of time traveling in the United States. But as another example, emigration meant a lot of former nobles had experience of, for example, Britain's more liberal culture and politics, and a lot of them came away impressed, thinking that France could do to imitate that. So, as I said, emigres went everywhere. Austria, Russia, the United States, but London was sort of the epicenter. You can see here a political cartoon from Britain at the time showing a bewigged aristocrat meeting a stolid John Bull, the representative of the British people. People went where they went for safety. Britain, obviously, was being protected by the English Channel, and the English Navy was less vulnerable to attack. But they also had money, and Britain provided foreign subsidies, as did many other countries. So you could get paid, subsidized, in the same way that many countries today provide some subsidies to refugees. But these subsidies weren't enough. And a lot of these newly poor nobles were forced to do something truly horrendous, which is work. These are people who've been living off their income from their estates for a long time, but the French government took steps to stop emigres from benefiting from their assets. They seized the assets often. They stopped money from moving overseas. And so you had a whole host of incredibly prominent dukes, duchesses, counts who were forced to take up fairly menial jobs. The Comtesse de Sacyvelle started a business making straw hats. The Marquise de La Tour-du-Pin became a linen worker. The Duchesse de Gontaut sold paintings. And the Duc d'Orléans, who I mentioned, who would later become King of France, worked as a teacher. Now, it was possible to go too far. Making hats was seen as tolerable, but noble was court-martialed by his social club and expelled for the crime of becoming a servant, which is seen as just too degrading, much more degrading than making hats. But eventually, the danger receded, and emigres started to go back home. Even into the 1790s, you had some people returning home as the governments rose and fell in Paris. But especially once Napoleon took power, he took efforts to try to bring emigres back. So in 1800, there's an edict that said all emigres who hadn't taken up arms against France were welcome to return. In 1802, even the ones who fought against France were allowed to come back to France. In 1801, Napoleon struck a deal with the Catholic Church, which brought a lot of the clergy back, who had fled because they were unwilling to accept the revolution's religious changes. But there were a few diehards, several thousand, who remained in exile all the way to the end until Napoleon fell in 1814.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
In 1807, there were 1,461 emigres in England, of whom 808 were laity and the rest were clergy. But still, the alacrity with which most emigres returned at the first possible moment was a little bit embarrassing to the true believers, the ones who were going to refuse to go back to France until the Ancien Régime was restored. The leader of the emigres in England, the ultra-reactionary Comte d'Artois, was basically forced to give returning emigres his blessing, because he was advised that they were going to go back regardless, so he'd better make it look like he approved if he didn't want to turn them against him. So these emigres came back to France, and this is what I want to really focus on after sort of laying the groundwork for what happened here. Whether they came back in 1800 or 1814, emigres generally returned to less money, less status, and less power than they had had before they left. So let's focus on that money first. I mentioned how the revolution had taken steps to prevent the assets and the money of the emigres from being sent to them overseas so they could benefit. And a lot of that was from confiscating property. The revolution confiscated huge swaths of land owned by the Catholic Church, as well as there's a law that meant that if you emigrated, your property back in France could be forfeit. So most of these emigres had some of their property confiscated. This ultimately ended up being up to one-fifth of all noble-owned property in France. So that was bad enough. You came back and your property was gone. On top of that, noble privileges were abolished by the revolution. So before the revolution, nobles had been exempt from a lot of taxes. One estimate was that about 5% of noble wealth was taken by taxes before 1789. After the revolution, there was a uniform land tax that fell on everyone of around 16%. So much higher taxes. Nobles had also received money from so-called feudal dues, which were ancient privileges that they had the right to extract from their peasants on their land. So they might have a right to confiscate a share of their peasants' crops. They might have a monopoly on the use of the village's mill or olive press. They might be able to charge peasants for the right to transfer land or to get married. And there was what was known as the corvée, which was the right to force your peasants to work on your lands for a certain amount of days per year, building roads or doing other sort of labor. And all of these were abolished in the revolution. So before the revolution, you'd had income come from a certain number of areas, from these feudal dues, from rents in your land, et cetera. And now all this was gone. So that meant that many, not all, but many of these emigres came back home to being almost as poor as they had been when they were in exile and having to make hats or whatever. One estimate was the average noble family was about one-third poorer after the revolution than before. That the average provincial noble family saw its annual income reduced by a third, from around 8,000 francs before the revolution to about 5,200 francs per year after. But it's important to keep in mind when talking about this one-third reduction to 5,200 francs per year, that the average peasant farmer in this time might earn 300 or 400 francs per year. So while these emigres were poorer, they were not exactly destitute. One example, we talked about the Marquise de La Tour du Pin earlier, who became a linen worker. She lamented that the revolution, quote, ruined my father-in-law and our family fortunes never recovered. She estimated that her family's income had been slashed by 58,000 francs per year. But of course, that still left them with 22,000 francs per year, which is a lot less, but still probably in the top 1% of French society. But even nobles who weren't quite so rich, and there were a lot of them, would lament it, heard to lament when they were preparing to go back home, where shall I go to hide my poverty? It was deeply embarrassing to be an impoverished noble, because being of noble blood and being rich were supposed to go hand in hand. Being in debt was one thing, but being actually poor was something else entirely. Some nobles were so embarrassed that they just stopped acting like nobles. They pretended to be commoners. They stopped using their title, their seal, their visiting cards, because it was less embarrassing to just seem to be an ordinary commoner getting by than to be a count who was penniless and living in a shack. De La Tour du Pin, who I've mentioned before, said that her family had been, quote, forced to contrive a living, sometimes by the sale of the few possessions remaining to us, and sometimes by taking salaried posts. You can sort of hear the disdain dripping from her voice there at the thought of having to work for a living. Being an exile is one thing, making hats, but once you're back in France, the idea of having to take a position for the salary was deeply humiliating. Many of the nobles who still had some money tried to use it to buy back their confiscated property. Or they found people who were willing to loan them money to do so. Sometimes these buyers agreed to sell, which restored the pride and income. But though a lot of property did return, some people lamented that all their efforts to keep themselves afloat were in vain. Whether or not they had money left, these returning emigres suffered an intense loss of social status. The clergy, which had previously been largely independent, funded by vast land holdings and a direct 10% tithe that they could impose on the population, they're now employees of the government. Noble titles were legally abolished by the revolution. When Napoleon finally brought his own noble titles back, that meant that the old nobility now had to share their titles and their status with new nobility. And finally, people who had been feudal lords now find themselves being merely landlords. Instead of having special social rights, they were just rich, collecting rents. And many commoners took great pride in showing their new legal equality with their former masters, including the ultimate indignity of suing them and taking them to court over various disputes. Finally, the returned emigres found that they had a lot less power. All the ancient privileges and influence were gone, the regional parlements that had given many nobles a voice. If they wanted power, they had to work for Napoleon. And Napoleon could always decide that he didn't like you anymore and was going to fire you, or worse. The famous writer Chateaubriand found that out when he published a pamphlet attacking Napoleon. The emperor shut down Chateaubriand's newspaper, seized his property, and almost arrested him. But still, many former emigres were more circumspect, kept their heads down, worked under Napoleon, even if deep down they wished that the Bourbons, the family of Louis XVI, were still ruling France. And then comes 1814, and the Bourbons come back. Napoleon is defeated, abdicated. The Bourbons return. The last emigres come back to France. And they find themselves finally, both the ones who just came back and the ones who'd been there all along, finally had new access to power, wealth, and status. The church had new prominence, new resources. It got more funding. There's a determined drive to recruit new priests, to give them more money, to re-evangelize the population. The Restoration government had a chamber of peers modeled on the House of Lords, which is hereditary appointment. That had a handsome salary. Emigres took roles in political organizations, a movement called ultra-royalism. That sometimes controlled the elected chamber of deputies, took a role in shaping national power. Louis had a royal bodyguard. It was staffed by men whose bloodlines were rather more impressive than their military records. There are civil service jobs now available. 70% of Restoration prefects were members of the noble class. And again, I'm sort of conflating nobility and emigres here. As I said, not all nobles emigrated, not all emigres are nobles. But this is the most prominent group here. And in general, whether you were an ultra-royalist or more moderate, so the Restoration was good news for the kind of person who had tried to emigrate. There were exceptions, of course. Finally, there were military appointments available, not as it was before the Revolution, when only nobles could become officers, but a lot of emigres were able to get cushy jobs in the military. And I want to highlight one example here because it's particularly telling. A fellow named Hugues Duroy de Chamaret was a noble emigre, and in 1814, after coming back to France after a generation abroad, he was appointed to command a frigate, despite the fact that he hadn't put to sea in two decades. And on his very first voyage, he crashed his ship into a reef, killing more than 100 people in one of the most infamous shipwrecks in European history before the Titanic. You might have seen this image of the aftermath. But despite all this new social power and privilege, all these jobs that were available, it was never enough. For every emigre who was given a sinecure, many more were denied jobs that they wanted. The Restoration kept the Napoleonic nobles, so the old nobles still had to coexist with these new upjump parvenus. Clergy were, despite their higher prominence, were still state employees. The feudal dues were gone. The confiscated lands were never returned. And the Ancien Regime in a whole was never restored. The Restoration was, despite many people wanting it to be, was always more of a compromise with the revolution than a repudiation of it. Still, a lot of these emigres felt that the government was now on their side, or at least ought to be, and sort of threw around their perceived power. So a lot of nobles and clergy alike tried to pressure the owners of their confiscated property to give it back. Some clergy refused holy sacraments to anyone who still owned confiscated property. There are some areas where nobles still lorded over their peasants like before. I addressed them with the informal tu pronoun, like they were children. There's one restored noble who we're told treated his peasants like slaves. Quote, woe to whoever didn't remove his hat while speaking to him, for a blow with his walking stick soon knocked off the offending headgear. This wasn't universal, but it was common. There's a famous song from the period that ran, see this old marquee bloke treats us like conquered folk. And it's impressive that rhyme managed to translate over from French to English. Always glad when that happens. It makes my life much easier. But despite all this, there was no putting the genie back in the bottle. France had changed for good. Those efforts to recover the confiscated land, denying the sacraments and all that, that was deeply unpopular. It sparked a huge backlash, which ultimately contributed to Napoleon's return in 1815 on a wave of unpopularity for the Bourbons. This didn't last. He was defeated at Waterloo and exiled again to St. Helena. This all remained unpopular, and Louis's government, despite many people wanting to return the land, was never able to give it back. There was ultimately in 1825 some compensation, some taxpayer money was used to compensate people who had their land confiscated, but this was sort of seen as a half measure. Clergy continued to be state employees. Nothing that the emigres wanted, they were not able to get back what they had before, and this was deeply humiliating by people who thought that their time had finally come and they should have had it back. But I want to close by noting something that was maybe not always so easy to see at the time for the people going through this, was that many of these emigres and their descendants lived life of wealth, power, and privilege after coming back home. It was just not the kind they thought they deserved. And from a distant perspective, it's easy to see, on the one hand, that many of these people were doing just fine for themselves, but also, of course, that, you know, in our time, you can earn $70,000 and be a perfectly fine salary, and so is $100,000. But if you go from $100,000 to $70,000, that's going to upend your life a bit. So it makes sense that people had difficulty adapting to their drastically reduced circumstances. But this definitely contributed to a lot of instability in France. There's resentment of the emigres. Emigres resented people right back. There were governments that rose and fell, conspiracy theories, secret groups. It was all very dramatic. I don't have any more time to go into it. I've already gone longer than I intended. If you like what you heard here, you can listen to the Siecle, which is my ongoing podcast telling the story of France from 1814 to 1914. You can also visit the website where I have full annotated transcripts of every episode.
Well, thank you, David. We already have a question from Andrew, who asked, how did the non-noble emigres fit into the restoration debates like national lands?
So it really sort of depended. In the popular... In the writings at the time, most of the vile the anger is directed at the nobles and the clergy. They're the most prominent. They're the wealthiest. I mean, you know, nobody really cared that much, except maybe in your village if you were a peasant who had left the country for 6 months, something like that. But if you were the Duke of so and so, then what you did impacted a whole lot of people. So it's a question of perspective. If you're telling the story of an individual or a small village, then these decisions that ordinary members of the Third Estate are deeply important for history from sort of a social history perspective. But from a political history perspective, these commoner emigres were much less significant as players. So it sort of depends on which approach you want to do historically.
Great. So next question from Daniel. Are there still open claims today from emigres?
No. That 1825 compensation package, the so-called emigres billion, as it was called, deeply unpopular, but it sort of worked. It settled a lot of the outstanding claims. It gave nobles money that many could use to buy back their property, maybe at a premium if people didn't want to sell before. It also meant that the people who'd owned that property now finally for the first time felt secure that the government wasn't going to take it away, because now there'd been this compensation, and that this was this huge sort of festering sore of people were terrified that the government was going to try to restore, to seize back this land, which was a continued, you know, Louis XVIII swore up and down repeatedly that, no, we're not going to do this. He even put it in the Constitution that this land was never going to be returned. But people still didn't believe it. And there are still instances of decades and decades after the fact of politicians accusing nobles long after this time period of plotting to recover their confiscated land, or of plotting to reimpose the 10% tithe. So it remained an ongoing political issue, but generally speaking, it was not a mass political issue after the 1820s.
Great. So Stephanie asks, do you have any episodes specifically about the children born abroad but who moved back to France with their parents later in their childhood, third culture kids of their time, so to speak?
I don't have any episodes on that, and those actually are not super visible in the sources. There are a lot of people in the sources who were young men and young women when they went into emigration, and came back 20 years later as adults whose lives have been shaped in many ways. One of the common experiences was that all the French kings of this time, for like a 40-year period, were huge Anglophiles. They loved Great Britain because they'd spent their formative years of their life in exile there. Also, of course, they recognized that from a geopolitical standpoint, France couldn't beat Britain, so they might as well join them. But there were definitely lots of instances of people whose lives were deeply shaped by being emigres, of the experience of being poor, of the experience of living in other cultures. Certainly knowing English was common. There was a ton of cross-channel visits by members of the upper classes of both countries, in part because so many emigres had lived in England, spoke the language now, and had good contacts there.
So Cynthia asks, do you have any idea of how many or what percentage of the ancient regime period went extinct?
I mean, this is a complicated question, because the Ancien Régime didn't have, there was no formal registry of who was a noble. But there's a huge informal effort, both before the revolution and after the revolution, to create unofficial peerages, books that accounted sort of who's who, Burke's peerage for France. And there were lots of different private groups. There were huge feuds between publishers of different competing books of the peerage. People sued each other, accused each other of being frauds. So-and-so claimed to have noble backing but wasn't. Some of these were basically monetary scams where you had to pay to be listed. So there's all sorts of efforts to try to track this. But generally speaking, it was, unless you were of the sort of the grand upper nobility, it didn't make much of a ripple if your family died out. Most people didn't care. And it was also over the sort of 30 years after the revolution, after Napoleon, there was it was fairly easy to fake being a noble. You could just start calling yourself, instead of, for example, Honoré de Balzac, the famous writer. He was born Honoré Balzac. He started using the so-called noble particle, the de, in there, which makes you sound like a noble because it made him sound more impressive. And there's no law against that, generally speaking. Lots of people did that. If you've read The Count of Monte Cristo, a major portion of that plot are commoners who are pretending to be nobles because they have money, and they sort of manufacture a fake noble identity, and no one really cares. Obviously, like, if people did care, there were it was a huge scandal if it was found out, but it was relatively easy to do.
No more questions from the chat right now. I have a question, though. You've talked a lot about the influence that the emigre community played in French politics. What impact did they have on the politics of the countries they emigrated to?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it was something I thought about adding to the presentation, but ultimately, and probably correctly, decided I didn't have time for. The best evidence we have for Britain where there's the most emigres and the freest press. So you have a lot of contemporary accounts published of reactions. And as you might expect today, seeing how refugees are treated in first world countries, it was controversial. Some people didn't like that the British government was paying a subsidy to exiled Catholic priests. That was seen as backing popery in some areas. And there was that image of the enraged, it's called the Enraged Dancing Master, that cartoon there, is making fun of the exiled French noble. The cartoon has a joke about the Britain that trying to enforce a tax on hops, with a pun on the plant and dancing. But so there was some resentment, but most sources seem to find that on the whole, the emigres were accepted. Many of them were welcomed in, the aristocrats were welcomed into high society in England. There's certainly some influence. There are ties that were forged between British nobles who met the French exiles, which would then prove lasting into the 1820s, 1830s. And of course, all these emigres helped provide a spur for the countries they were in to not compromise, to keep fighting Napoleon. It would have been embarrassing for Britain to make a permanent peace with Napoleon when they were also playing host to Louis XVIII in exile and his whole family. It would seem that they had obligations beyond what they wanted to do. So the emigres sort of constituted a spur to not compromise and to not make peace.
Thank you again for listening. Remember to register for the Barricades Convention, April 22nd to 24th, if you'd like to hear me and others talk about Les Miserables. That's at barricadescon.com. Instead of blathering on more, I'll just wrap this up and get back to working on the next episode. Join me very soon for episode 29, The Doctrinaires.
Around 10,000 BCE, families and tribes of the ancestors to the people of Britain would arrive in the southern part of the island after crossing from land that bridged from Europe. The Welsh built houses, communities, kingdoms, and continued to survive through Romans, Saxons, Danes, and Normans. The language and culture influenced by these sources continued to change and thrive, becoming ancient and modern at the same time. Join me as we travel through the history, meeting the kings, queens, nobles, and everyday people that create and grew modern Wales from the seeds of the ancient past. Creoso, and welcome to the Welsh History Podcast.